Well, it comes from your breath. So when you make, when you become a divine being, means that you have to take every part of yourself to bring that divinity down into your own humanity, into your own spirituality, and make every part of yourself should be connected to God, including your breath. But that's part of you. It's not just it's not just something that, that was. The past, as it is a part of you today, that is what you have to correct. So until you reach that point where you're not responsible, you're first developing as a human being, as a spiritual being, you're not responsible. But once you reach the stage where you have the capacity to become a divine being, now you're responsible for everything about yourself. If it was simply a points game, reward and punishment, and you get enough points, you get the prize, and you don't get, you get merits and demerits and then points. And if it's a point system, then it doesn't make sense. Either you're responsible or you're not responsible. But if we're talking about an establishing a relationship with God, then that's what Torah is all about. That's what mitzvah is all about. Becoming a divine being and bringing divinity into the world, then every part of you has to be, every part of you, every part of what makes you you has to become divine. In, you first have to transcend all those things that make you you. You have to go out of yourself, beyond yourself. You have to connect to God. Then you have to turn around and sanctify and bring godliness into everything that makes you you. Into your life, into your land, into your environment, into your parents' house, into your heredity. You have to take every part of you that makes you you and make that, elevate that to the state of the divine. So and that's why it's very interesting. In halacha, you don't find this concept. They have to repent for the sins that you did before. In Kabbalah, you find this concept. In Kabbalah, it says that a person is obligated to correct the sins that he did before his bar mitzvah. In halacha, it doesn't say it. In Jewish law, in the laws of tshuva, Rambam doesn't mean that you're obligated to repent for the things you did when you were a child. In Kabbalah, it says that you can't enter into the spiritual, the lights of the spiritual worlds until you correct it, all the things that you did as a child. So which is it? And the answer is, from a legal point of view, did I discharge my obligation? Do I have more merits than demerits? Do I have more marks on the plus side than on the minus side? Yeah. From that point of view, you don't have to, you're not responsible. You're not legally responsible. But in the relationship between the two and God, in the true purpose that underlies all things, the true purpose of existence, you can't make the next step without doing it. You can't go in the next world and experience that kind of relationship with God without having first made every part of your being sanctified. Can't be done. So it comes out like this. That in the beginning of the process of becoming a divine being, my focus is primarily on going out of myself and connecting to the divine, connecting to God. The completion of the process is the reverse. It's taking that bond, that innate bond and connection to God that I have, and bringing it into every part of me.
Can you say that again?
In the process of developing a relationship, in the process of developing this relationship with God, there's two steps to the process. The first step is lech lecha, that you have to go out of yourself, out of all those things that limit you and define you, and connect to God. The second half of the process is doing the reverse. Taking that connection that you have developed with God, that attachment to divinity that you now experience, and bring that into all of your endeavors, all of your activities, in every corner and area of your life.
How do you know what stage you're at? Is it a back and forth?
So generally...
Is that like Sumira? Sumira, I mean, I'm trying to fit it in with Sumira and how they talk.
In a very general kind of way, but not necessarily. I mean, to a degree, it can be. You could use that model. So there's two issues here. There's the issue of in my own personal life, and then there's the how do I know where I'm holding in that step of the process in my own personal life. But the fact is, there's also I, as I belong to the collective Jewish people. Where is the Jewish people as a whole holding in that process?
Bring it back in.
And therefore, and depending on where the Jewish people as a whole is holding in that process, in terms of the global picture, that will also have a tremendous effect and influence on how I, as a private individual, where I have to focus my energy. When the Rebbe comes and tells us that the redemption is here, that the Mashiach is here, that everything is here already, mm-hmm. and the revelation of God is here, all you have to do is accept that. All you have to do is accept that. What does that mean? Just words. Everything's here. All you have to do is open your eyes and see it. All you have to do is accept this as reality. But I don't see it. What do you mean? What does it mean? What it means is that they're ever saying that we're at the end of the process. And in the end of the process, our job is not to run away from the world. To run away from the world because we perceive the world as, because we're still in the stage where our where the world is contradictory to divinity, and therefore we have to leave it and go away from it in order to connect to the divine. In the end of the process is the opposite. We are resolving the conflict between the divine and the world. We're bringing divinity into the world. Before we have to escape the world, before we have to escape our limitations, our humanity, our whatever it might be that holds us back from being divine. Now we don't have to run away from those things anymore. In fact, we're going towards those things. We're leaving the Beis HaMikdash and going back to Chutz La'aretz. We're bringing the holiness of the Beis HaMikdash into outside the Holy Land. So not only is outside not a conflict to holiness, but in fact we're bringing the holiness into the outside. But even in that part of the process, there's still the sense that the world in and of itself is not divine, and I have to introduce divinity into it. It requires an effort on my part to introduce that. It's true, I have already gone beyond the natural limitations of the world. I have already become a divine being, but the rest of the world still needs the divinity imposed upon it. It has to be introduced to the world, because the world itself is not naturally open to divinity. When the second half of the process has been completed, then you're living in a world which is completely and totally receptive to divinity. And now your job is not bringing divinity into the world, but revealing the divinity that is already there.
Fine.
You. You're way ahead of us all.
Well, I understand that. You are bringing divinity into the world.
Well, cool, but if we're saying that the job is already completed,
that doesn't go along with what you said earlier. The first half was that you would go away from who you were and into divinity.
Maybe.
When that is completed,
that's the equivalent of
right. No, when that is completed, then you have to start the next process,
which is bringing
divinity down into the world. When that is completed, what's now? When that is completed, when the Rebbe comes along and says that is completed, so now what are you? Now what are we supposed to be doing? And the answer is you're supposed to recognize and accept, train yourself to recognize the divinity that already exists in the world.
What's the difference between 2 and 3?
Good question.
The 2? What's the difference between 2 and 3?
Yeah, between 2 and 3.
2 meaning?
2 is bringing holiness into the world. Okay. 3 is revealing.
Okay. Bringing holiness into the world means that the way I perceive the world is I perceive a world which is hostile to holiness. And in fact, which is why I left the world to begin with in order to connect to holiness. I had to eschew the world as I know it, in order to connect to holiness. Which is why in earlier generations, connected to holiness was very much associated with the...
leaving, becoming totally...
Right, asceticism and so on and so forth. Really, really, you know, breaking yourself. So I had to break myself in order to connect to that which is higher than myself. Now, in order to bring that which is higher than myself back into the world with me, what I have to do is, I have to do something similar to the world. I have to kind of, I'm coming down to people who didn't do the work. I did the work, right? But the physical world did not do the work. The rest, so I have to bring that connection to God that I have into the world in a way where the world is still resisting it. The world itself is resistant to that, which is why I had to run away from the world in the first place. But now I'm strong enough in my bond, the connection to God, that I can overcome the world's resistance and bring the godliness into the world. I don't have to run away from the resistance. I don't have to run away from doing battle with the world. Now I can do battle with the world.
Okay.
The next step is, okay, what do you do after you finish the battle and you won? What now? You won, you did the battle and you won, you finished. Now what? Now what means to recognize, to develop an appreciation and a recognition of what is already here. For many people, this is even harder than fighting the world. Again, even though it's not hard to work, it's harder in terms of the shift that you have to make internally.
Yeah.
It's easier work. It's not harder work. The inner change in mindset and outlook at the world as we know it, we're used to seeing, like this person you're talking to is used to seeing
anti-Semitism. He's worried.
Right, he sees the world in he lives in a world that's in conflict with his Torah.
Right.
And therefore he has two choices. In certain situations, he's forced to stick with the Torah and resist the world. In other situations, he's forced to give in to the world and compromise on his Torah.
Right. Okay.
Because he sees a world in conflict. There are other people who see a world in conflict that refuse to compromise.
Right. Power them.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. I'm going with my yarmulke and my grid. If you don't like it, I'll sue you. That's it. Try to fire me. Try to hold me back from promotion. I'll sue you. So they're out there and they're winning. Not that they're not winning. They're winning. They're out there. We sued back. We won everything. We want everything, you Sabbath observance and then yarmulkes and beards, and we want it.
What's that? Menorahs.
Yeah. but there's still an attitude of conflict with them. The next step is an attitude of being at peace with the world. There is no conflict except in your perception.
Right.
The conflict no longer exists.
Fine.
Only in your perception. Because the conflict exists in your perception, therefore the conflict exists in your experience too. Why is that? To give a very simple muscle. Okay. A person wants to train a horse. What do you do to train a horse? The first thing that you have to teach a horse is you can't do whatever you want. He's running wild, he's running all over the place, you have to tie him down, keep him in place, and that's it. He's jumping, he's pulling, he's running, he's this, he's that, the rope, so that he can't go wherever you want. The first thing he has to learn is he can't go wherever you want. Your old life as a horse, where you ran free of it, that's over. You have to get away from that old. That's fine. But at the time, he's still resisting and fighting the owner, the trainer that's trying to train. The next step is, once he's already broken, at least to the point that he's open to already start taking some command. So the next step is to start giving the horse commands. The horse is not ready to be taught specific tasks. But even then, very often he needs a carrot or a sugar cube. And sometimes he needs a whip. Right? He needs a stick. You have to give him a... What happens if after the training is over and you've succeeded and the horse is now fully trained? So the horse is now fully trained. Whatever you say, it does. So what happens when you take an animal that's fully trained and you give it a zest? It's going to kick you back. An animal that's fully trained, and you have no reason in the world to give it a zest. If you give it a zest for no reason, what's it going to do? It's going to kick you back. What do you give me a zest for? What? But not because, but in other words, the conflict is only there because you created the conflict. You can still have a conflict with this horse, but you have to create it.
Okay.
The horse itself will do whatever you tell it to do. But if you decide to kick it out of the blue for no reason, it's going to kick you back. What's right? The world itself, that I was saying, is the world itself. You yourself, not just the world global, you yourself are ready for everything. You have everything in you. The highest connection with God, the highest connection with Torah, the highest connection with the world, living every instant and every moment of your life in complete sanctity and holiness. The problem is that you're so used to a world of conflict that you're engaging the world in conflict. And when you engage the world in conflict, it fights back.
Yeah.
And you're engaging yourself in conflict. You're working with yourself with the assumption that there's two parts of you and they're at war with each other, which is the old model. It's true. If you open a Tanya, if you open it, just says that you have two parts and they're at war with each other. But when the Rebbe comes and says that the war is over, it's true. Those two parts were supposed to be at war for each other for thousands of years, and now that war is over. So you're not supposed to be looking at how the good part of me should win the bad part of me. No. You're supposed to be looking at how is it that the part of me, how is it that the animal in me is really also divine?
Fine. In that case, thank God. Why are we learning time?
Oh, good question. I ask myself every day, what am I doing?
It's like ancient stuff, man.
Outdated.
I don't want to say in public because I get stoned, you know. But those are my thoughts.
The body cycle. What happens with a kid who grows up with an already trained animal? So this kid, he looks at the animal. The animal is nice, the animal is friendly, the animal is... But you still have to explain to the kid. In order for the kid to really appreciate the animal, you have to explain to the kid that you should know that once upon a time this was a wild animal. In order to appreciate the devotion, the loyalty of the animal, and how to utilize the animal properly, you have to know what it once was. And you have to know that if you give it a zest, it could kick. The animal can still kick. It's very nice, it's like this, but remember, if you give it a kick, it can kick back. You have to know, in order to appreciate the resolution of a conflict, in order to appreciate peace, you have to know what war is. A, to kids who never grew up, the kids who grew up in peacetime, and they didn't know what a war is, so they don't appreciate peace. So they don't even know what peace is. If you don't know what war is, you don't know what peace is.
I don't think that applies to anybody, really.
Sorry?
It doesn't apply to anybody in this generation. Because everybody, I mean, those...
No. So I'm saying like this. In order to better appreciate, let's say the person who actually himself lived through the war, not the person who was born after the war, the person who himself actually lived through the war, and now he's living in peacetime, he can also get used to things and forget, not fully appreciate what he has. In order to fully appreciate, and that's why you see, I remember reading in a book about a fellow described being in the concentration camp. And he said, what thought sustained him throughout his years in the concentration camps? What kept him going? What kept him going was that he was 100% certain that after this terrible experience, Jews would be completely unified. He had grown up in a Europe where Jews were split by all kinds of parties and politics, and there was terrible infighting amongst the Jews. And to him, he felt that after such a tremendous holocaust, after such tremendous suffering, surely the entire Jewish people will be totally and completely unified. And as terrible as the suffering is, to him, that thought was enough to sustain him, to keep him going through the war, that he wants to live to see the time when all Jews will be completely unified. What happened?
Nothing
general. Right. The Jewish community became more splintered and more fractured and more pulled apart than ever before, in certain ways.
Why?
Because, and not because it was guys even the people who themselves experienced the war and thought to themselves that after the war's over, all Jews are going to be unified. But once you're out of it, and now it's peacetime, I want it my way, you want it your way. That's it. I'm me, you're you. We see things differently, so... You make your party, I'll make my party. The same people. You have to be able to relate to wartime in order to appreciate peace. So it's very important to learn time. It's very important to learn time to understand what the nature of the conflict is, and there, in order to appreciate what the nature of the resolution of the conflict. In order to appreciate that your nefesh avraham, your animal soul, is not interested in fighting anymore. It doesn't want to fight, it wants peace. It wants to be holy, it wants to be divine. But you're still fighting with it. The world around you is not interested in fighting you anymore. They want to be holy, they want to be divine. But you're still fighting the world. And therefore the world is still fighting with you. And fighting the world doesn't necessarily mean in a fight. Like, take the situation in Eretz Yisrael. Because you're still living in your godless mentality, and you perceive the world as something that is by definition in conflict with being a Jew, and therefore you either have to bend, and you have to give in, and you have to compromise, and you have to sell out. That's why the world is still fighting. But if you would get up to the world and say, world, there's nothing more in the world I want than peace. There's nothing more in the world I want than brotherhood. There's nothing more in the world I want than... And the way to do this is God's way. God said the land of Israel belongs to the Jews. So we're going to do it God's way. So the Rebbe says if you would do that, you'd have peace. Doesn't make sense. What's the logic? We've seen it from experience. But what's the logic? The Rebbe says, if you try to give in and try to make friends by giving them, by coming bearing gifts, which is what Yaakov did to Esau, which is what Jews have done for thousands of years, if you're going to come to try to win friends bearing gifts, you're going to get a war. And Jews are going to get killed. And if you're going to stand up and say, excuse me, did I ever tell you about the first Rashi and Chumash? Right? This is what it says. Tell them that there's a Rashi in Chumash that says that the reason why God described creation is in order that we should have an answer to say that the man who created the world, he's the one who gave it to us. This is what he wants, and therefore, sorry, I can't bargain with his plans. It's not mine to bargain. It's what he wants. So, you know, if
we'll sue them. We'll sue them.
We'll sue. So the Rebbe says, then you won't have peace. What's the sense of it? Mm-hmm. So again, if you assume that the world is by definition incompatible with Torah, therefore you have to bend the Torah, and you have to bend your knee to the world in order to survive. But if you recognize that the world by definition, the reality of the world is defined by Torah, that the way Torah defines reality, that is now actual reality, then when you live your life that way, when you turn around and say, it says in Torah, then they'll say, oh, it says in Torah. That's a different book.
Yeah.
When you approach the world in a way that is the reality, then the world will respond in kind. Because that's really where the world is all. There is no more conflict except in our own minds. Right. So we sustain. And just like we stood up to the communists, and just like we stood up to this, we stand up to these guys, and you know what? That was his fun bragging. It was very inspiring. Within a few days, another guy comes back from Russia, and he's saying it's unbelievable. He says, everybody helps me, starting from the mayor down. It's a different city. The mayor tells me his office is open to me anytime. He said it was right before Pesach, we didn't have water, and we couldn't cook. We had to cook everything, this, that, there was no water. And this, I was trying this official, that official. So finally got all the way to the commissioner in charge of water and this and that. And he says, why didn't you call me right away? Why are you talking to these lawyers? Call me right anytime you need anything. And the guy made sure that they delivered water straight to the Chabad house and they were able to cook. And he says they gave him free time on television and free time on radio. They gave him a building and they gave him, and they recognized his school as having full rights. And wherever he goes and whatever he does. I'm listening to this guy, I'm thinking, this is crazy, this is mamash. It's like, this is Twilight Zone, because these two guys describing Russia, and it's like totally different. And I'm listening, I'm waiting for, what's the clue, what's the key to this guy? So when they asked him, they said, how did you make these connections with the, you know, people finally asked him. I mean, he's describing all these miraculous, amazing things. So he said that when he first came to the town, he had a plaque made up, a beautiful plaque with the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, with the seven Noahide laws. And he came and he announced that he wants to make a presentation in the name of the International Chabad Lubavitch World Organization to his honor the mayor. And he came to the mayor's office and the press was there, and he made a presentation of this plaque explaining to him that Lubavitch, no matter what happened to Lubavitch, it stands for love, and it means love in Russian, and it stands for love for all human beings, and we have a message for all human beings. We have the laws of Torah for Jews, we have the seven Noahide laws for non-Jews, and I want to present his honor, the mayor, with the plaque of the seven Noahide laws. What was the difference? The first guy grew up listening to stories about communists and persecution and this and that. So when he came back to Russia and he was able to come in legally and cross the border as a free man, he came in looking for a fight. Now we're finally going to get what we have coming to us. The other guy, he looked at it all totally different. He said, listen, it's all miraculous. It's miracles. The world isn't fighting us anymore. They're not fighting us anymore. So let's come in friendship. There's no fight. And they both got exactly what they were looking for. One came looking for a fight and he got it. The other guy came looking for love and peace and mutual cooperation and he got it. Exactly, the whole difference was on how they looked at the situation. And they acted accordingly. And the response was exactly the way they are. That was the response.
Isn't that the same with life in general, though? You get what you want.
That's people say that. People pay people pay $1,000 to hear motivational speakers say that. Then they all go home and depressed and pop pills and you know, five guys out of every thousand that paid the
seriously,
price to hear the speech.
I have this idea.
Did I ever say previously you couldn't go 100 years ago you could have gone into a Russian government official with a plaque of the seven no-eyed laws, you'd take you out and have you shot. Okay? That's it. You couldn't, that's it. It's a different reality. It's a different way.
Okay, fine. So in our, in our reality, so your life is what you make it, basically.
In a very superficial kind of way. I mean, now. Now, what the chiddush, what did I ever say? Your life is what you make it.
I'm not about
chiddush. No. Not your life is what you make it. There's a certain reality that is the actual reality. You can choose
what you want to live by.
You can choose various false realities.
Right, it's fine.
But the Rebbe is saying what's needed now is to choose the true reality. The true reality is that Torah is reality.
And everything's okay.
Hey, love.
Everything's okay. No, I don't mean like that. I mean,
take another few, you'll feel even better.
I mean, yeah. Shifts.
Everything's under control. Except us.
Even you. Even you.
Really, really, even yourself.
That's the chiddush. That's
the chiddush. The chiddush is even yourself.
Yeah. It's
that's the hardest thing.
It's amazing.
I can hear the whole world is beseder. I can hear that this is beseder. I can hear that
me.
That's philosophically theoretically. You tell what? Me? Me, I know. The guy, the mayor in Russia, I'm from a town in Russia, I don't know. So it sounds good. Me, I know.
I have to tell myself every day, you'll be okay. You're all right. You're a nice guy. I have to tell myself every day.
You're a divine being.
I know, it's Gavaldi.
No, you are one with God.
I am a divine being. But there is only divine being.
That's it. You and God are one and the same. And therefore every aspect of your life has to reflect that. Every move you make, every thought you think, every word you say, every deed you do, every breath you take.
Thank you, friends.
Was it you?
Chaim. Chaim. We should stop kicking the horse and get on its back and ride.
Oh, my.
Oh, Lord.
Profound, it's unbelievable. It's not just. This is like for life, this is for everything, this is for everything. I mean, you could be a millionaire. Seriously,
unbelievable. I know.
Why did he do it?
I have plans.
You have to use different terminology. It's amazing, isn't it? That's what I'm telling you, I'm doing as well. I mean, I'm white. There's 5 million people. There's enough of those to go around. And it's no contradict, and you can see that they have a very clear idea of where science ends and where Torah begins. And I see people who go into the self-help who have no idea
where their ideas begin and the Torah begins.
Yeah.
They have no idea. Time after, and people very learned, very chassidish, who have no idea where that stuff ends and Torah begins. None whatsoever.
Why is that?
Because it's a philosophy of life and how to live your life.
Where it's going where Torah.
And because some of the things are familiar, because some of the things mirror Torah principles, people, a lot of people who don't have, most people, I mean, almost anyway, I have met maybe one or two individuals that I can think of that have the sophistication in terms of understanding. Those who don't learn Panemius HaTorah for sure don't know where. I mean, they found out that there's a classic muscle work, okay, by a man named Rabbi Leo Dessler, that they learn all the Mishnah. So he never wrote it as a work. It's a collection of all his writings that they found. Lemaisa, they discovered that one of the writings that they found is an exact translation of the Reader's Digest condensed version of Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Say that again.
That one of his pieces that appears in this Messiah, the writings of Rabbi Leo Dessler, is a Hebrew translation that he wrote for himself of Dale Carnegie's, of the Reader's Digest abridged version. They matched it word for word. Of the Reader's Digest abridged version, which had come out in England in that year that he wrote it. They did the research. They found it. There's a whole...
He's joking. What are you talking about?
What?
He thinks he's joking.
No!
Why would Rabbi Dessler write that?
It's just what he's talking about. If, you know, it's for a person who's working on himself.
Oh, come on.
He wrote for himself.
First of all, it's another of Dessler knew Tanya. He quotes Tanya in there.
Hello. I'm not talking. Hello.
What's wrong with Reader's Digest? I'm sorry. What's wrong with Reader's Digest?
They showed that there's a very modern Orthodox institute in Israel that devotes a whole journal to secular influences in Torah writings. And they're proud of it. They think it's a good idea. So they're looking for secular influences in Torah writing. They show word for word. They bring in this journal. Whole piece of
I have Mr. Mielio. I'd love to see it.
They show word for word in this journal. A whole piece which is a translation of parts whole chapters of the Reader's Digest abridged version of Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, which came out in England at that time when he was living there.
That's a good book.
Because to a person who's working on self-improvement, he sees a secular book. Good ideas of self-improvement. He doesn't see any conflict with Torah. Good ideas of self-improvement.
Hey.
Like winding down. Like party's over, guys. We're finished.
Exactly. No, this is
we
a
did,
good
we
part.
Just had to get going.
I'm no, I'm
this.
Kidding.
Round two.
This is an exciting part of the brain.
Because if my emphasis is on self, let me tell you nothing about Rav Dessler. I also have Mechdum Eliyahu. Okay, I went through it. I was part of it.
Well, at least there's more than I can say about myself.
Rav Dessler took Tanya and turned it into, and took from it instead of God-centeredness, self-improvement with a self-centered. The point is that for those who didn't learn Panemius HaTorah, they for sure don't have the sophistication to distinguish between something which is self-centered and something which is God-centered, something which is divine.
Yeah.
Between the divine and the secular. But even people who have some exposure to Panemius HaTorah, what happens is when they, many of them don't have the level and degree of sophistication in terms of understanding the point of Panemius HaTorah, to be able to distinguish that when they see concepts that appear in the secular self-help or psychology. You know how many people I've met in this neighborhood that are involved in psychology? And I brought some of the Rebbe to be involved in psychology, and you talk to them, and you see they missed the boat.
Yeah.
And that wasn't what their bracha was for. Their bracha wasn't to miss the boat. Their bracha was to catch the boat. They've totally missed the boat.
No.
This is chassidic, this is geuladik, this is that, this is
no.
this. And
no.
they,
no.
And
no.
it's not that they're, it's not that they are recognizing certain things in the psychology that they're reading that is chassidic and geuladik, but it's all klipa.
No, how would you, there's no such thing as to be just said. Let me share, sir. Shmegel.
Again, it is possible for a person to be able to see within the klipa that ultimately the klipa itself is really being megala, mirroring and being megala lukus.
So what's the problem?
But I'm telling you that for a problem is that most people don't see that. Right. When they look at the klipa, their spirals is from the klipa.
The klipa. They think the ikki is the klipa, right?
Right. They look. They're not looking at the fruit.
Yeah,
they're looking at the klipa.
So
they're getting excited.
What's the point of doing it at all if your whole tachlis is to be able to look into it and say, oh, this is what it says in Torah, then why not just learn the Torah? Why bother this?
Oh. Why do I do it?
No, I'm saying, why would someone go to a psychology school? Why would somebody
need help? That's why.
Because the idea is to take the Torah and the divinity and bring it into the world. Into every aspect of the world. Every part of the world. But in a way that what should be revealed is Torah, what should be revealed is divinity, what should be revealed is godliness. Godliness has to be revealed in psychology and in self-help and in all of these things.
But it does that, Bamela does that. Because Klippa,
nothing happens.
Klippa mimics Kedusha. So Bamelo, psychology,
but it mimics Kedusha and opposes Kedusha. It mimics Kedusha and brings you to...
What is a Yiddish psychologist sitting in a psychology course going to help? What are they going to do?
What do you mean? I do it all the time. I help people with the psychology and the self-help, all that stuff that I've learned. I do it all the time.
Yeah, but not because of the books that you've read, the self-help books.
Because I have a worldly vehicle with which to deliver divinity. I have a worldly
package. So it's just a
package.
Facade? It's just a facade?
No, it's revealing the true nature of the world.
Wait a minute. You're going to be using techniques that you get from secular books to speak to people.
Not
how is that revealing Kedusha in the world?
Not techniques.
Oh, paradigms. You want to use... Okay.
What happens is like worldly versions.
It works, isn't it?
Of the Torah concept. Presented from the Torah perspective, not the worldly perspective.
Just use the Torah. Why didn't you bother with this?
Because the whole point of the Torah is that it's supposed to illuminate every area of existence in the world.
You're not illuminating.
Of course you are. I do it all the time. Where people get confused is where they stop looking on their own. That's where they get confused. When you hear it from me, you're not confusing what's the Torah and what's the people. Right? When I'm telling it to you, it's not confusing.
Hit the road, Jack.
Because when you try now go on your own and read the self-help, where you get confused, where's the distinction?
I mean, okay.
I present
the self-help books on money for God, so what's the point?
That is the whole premise of all the self-help books in success in financial careers. The whole 90% of the book is you have to drill into your head that I deserve to be rich.
Oh,
and enjoy
man.
Myself.
Oh, man.
And I'm worth it. And life is meant to be enjoyed. 90% of it. Because they'll all tell you that, you know what the hardest part is?
I mean.
That most people's problem with money is that they feel guilty about it.
Yeah.
So 90% of any good success book is don't feel guilty about being a selfish pig.
Yeah.
You can't say don't feel guilty about being a selfish pig. So you make a more sophisticated facade. That buy, so you do the supply side philosophy. That by bringing more wealth into the world and untapping your potential for wealth, the people around you benefit and it trickles down and others benefit and people, and in general you're a model for living life in a positive way, in a good way, and feeling good about you, blah blah blah. But basically it's how to succeed. By first step of success is you have the right to be a selfish pig.
No, you don't say.
That's not really like
that. That's the whole Napoleon Hill. The whole Napoleon Hill, the great Napoleon Hill. What did the great Napoleon Hill teach?
No.
That you had that most people don't become wealthy because they feel ambivalent about wealth. They feel guilty about it.
Yes.
The secret, what's the secret?
Don't feel guilty.
What is the secret?
The secret.